Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest today is comics artist Prentice Rollins. He's probably best known for his work on Green Lantern and Batman, but today he's promoting a new project, the desire to teach others how to draw, specifically sci-fi dystopias and utopias. So we will have an art lesson today for everyone. Welcome to the show, Prentice.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So how did you get started in your drawing career and then just jump right into comics?
I started drawing comics when I was 11, right around the time that Star Wars, the original, came out. Me and a friend started drawing our own Star Wars comics. I kept it up through adolescence. I was never actually a big comics reader. I mean, I had a small collection, but I didn't buy them regularly, you know, Marvel and DC things. But I just loved making up my own stories, and they were almost always science fiction stories. So I kept it up through adolescence, and in college, I was not actually an art student. I was a philosophy student, and a certain amount of time I was contemplating a career in academia. I went to graduate school for philosophy, and then when I was 25, I decided that I would like to take a crack at being a professional illustrator, a comics illustrator in particular. So I spent about 2 years working as a temp and taking some serious art classes at the Art Students League and School of Visual Arts in New York, where we lived. And then in 1993, about, I started getting my first jobs. I did an awful lot of work for Milestone Media, which was a company partnered with DC Comics, working on their characters, Hardware and Icon, the Blood Syndicate. And that led to jobs with DC proper. As you said, a lot of Green Lantern stuff, an awful lot of JLA stuff, a lot of Batman stuff, some X-Men work for Marvel, and it was mostly, by and large, inking. I penciled and inked Hardware for Milestone, but most of what I did for DC was inking, mm-hmm. Which I loved, and I still do. I, when I was a kid doing my own comics, I penciled, I inked, I colored, I wrote, I did the whole thing, and I never considered any one of those jobs any more or less important than any of the other ones. So that's mainly what I'm known for in comics. And the whole time I was, you know, doing that, I maintained this abiding interest in science fiction and in drawing science fiction stories. So that's the short form of my route into comics and illustration.
Well, the illustrations in this book, How to Draw Sci-Fi Utopias and Dystopias, is stunning.
Thank you.
I have tried to draw many yeah. different times in my life. I don't have an aptitude for it. My gifts lie in writing. But the steps you go through showing yeah. how the different forms, the people, the robots, the ships
yeah.
are, how like each step is gone through is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And so what comes to your mind when you imagine a scene or a scenario? What are the steps that inspire you to
right.
to draw that out?
I talk about this in the afterword of the book about inspiration and getting started, because it's something that illustrators get, and writers, of course, get asked so much. Where do you get your ideas? And, you know, there's this kind of myth that illustrators and writers are, you know, quote-unquote inspired people, that they have these ideas coming from the muse on high. And I know that, at least in my case, that simply isn't how it works. When all of my ideas ultimately originate with other illustrators, movies, writers, things that I've just been exposed to. And so, you know, this is, again, something I say in the end of the book is, you have to kind of get past this idea that there's some little, you know, pearl of creativity buried inside your brain, and everything's going to come out of that if only you get in the right place or something. It's closer to the truth, I think, at least in my case, to say that you just have to expose yourself to ideas, you know, to other artists, other writers, movies, books, and fill your head up, you know, as much as you can with that stuff. Let it kind of ferment and germinate, and then just start drawing, just start putting marks on paper. Most of the pieces in the book, I would basically, I mean, it's broken down into, you know, like a lot of similar books, it's broken down into sections like vehicles, spaceships, aliens and robots, cityscapes, humans. When I was plotting the book out, I broke it down into those sections, and then I basically wrote a list of things that I wanted to hit. Like, for example, with you know, robots, I wanted to do kind of a dystopian military robot. And for, you know, a spaceship, I wanted to do a gigantic generation ship, something, you know, miles long, traveling hundreds of years, you know, across from one star to the next. And so I came up with this kind of Christmas list of things that I wanted to present. And then I would go through each one of them, and I would basically just start, as I said, putting marks on paper to start sketching shapes. And, you know, once you start doing that, and don't get hung up on artist's block or anything, once you just start doing that, the ideas start to build around what you're doing. It's really just a matter of, for me at least, of just getting started, throwing yourself into it. Having said all that, there are definitely some influences of mine that loom large compared to others. H.R. Giger, for example, mm-hmm. and Sid Mead are two guys that I mentioned several times in the book as being illustrators that influenced me massively, and I think it shows.
Yeah, the section where you mentioned that certain of these images were inspired by Giger, I'm like, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, yeah. He Alien, when it came out in 1979, it was a life-changing movie for me. I mean, it remains to this day one of my, you know, top five favorite films, and it's not least of all just because of Giger's, you know, fantastic, nightmarish contributions. Yeah, when I was 13 and that came out, I went through phases as a kid. I mean, I spent a whole year drawing TIE fighters and a whole year drawing the Starship Enterprise and probably about a whole year drawing the Alien. and it just kind of gets, when you obsess over things like that and just do it over and over again, it just kind of gets built into your artistic DNA, and so finally, it just kind of spills out of you naturally, you know. I don't want to put myself in the same league as Giger, mind you. He was a great, great artist. Same with Sid Mead. But, you know, I think that you definitely, this is true for artists as much as for writers. I mean, you've got to have a god or two, you know, to kind of emulate, you know, a sort of a gravitational mass to orbit for a while. Not too close. You don't want to fall into them. you want to really learn as much as you can and then kind of go off on your own trajectory, you know.
And that gives me an image of the master artist being a huge gravity well, and you're just skirting along the outside of it until you can reach escape velocity and go off on your own, huh?
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. And the danger is you've got to avoid becoming a mimic or becoming a clone or, you know, a stamp of that person. So there's definitely a line to be tread, and you have to expose yourself to any number of people. And this is another thing that I kind of harp on in the book, in the first chapter, is the importance of influences. There's definitely another myth kind of out there, which is that they're dangerous, okay, and that if you allow yourself to be influenced, you will become a clone. and that can be avoided, but it's unavoidable that you have influences. I mean, it's very important. Just unavoidable.
What would you recommend for someone who wants to, someone who's already a pretty good artist but wants to improve their skills without, you know, going to an art school for a year or two?
Assuming that the person in question wants to become, say, a comic book artist or a commercial illustrator with comparable skills, one thing that I would highly recommend is basically getting a number of artistic anatomy books and copying drawings out of them. I did that. I hundreds of them, literally, during those 2 years that I mentioned when I was kind of honing my own skills. That was one thing that I did. If you want to get into comics, for example, or animation, you know, you're going to want to be at a level where you can draw human beings quickly and believably from your head. And there's no shortcut, really, for that. You know, you have to really invest time and, you know, do that legwork in terms of learning artistic anatomy. There are comics artists out there that take a good deal of it and they get away with it. But there's little things that I always, you know, little giveaways that always clue me in that they haven't quite done their homework. Ears, for example, ears are extraordinarily hard to draw because you look at them and they kind of, you know, seem like these amorphous, you know, seashell things on the side of the head. But like every part of the body, they have a structure that's uniform across all human beings. And if you want to draw ears authentically without a model in front of you, you got to learn that. So study your anatomy books, copy drawings out of them, take anatomy classes, draw a lot of things from life, and this is another thing I harp on in the first chapter, don't be afraid of using reference. It's easier than ever now that we have the internet. 20 years ago, before the internet, comics artists were, you know, required to pretty much keep a reference file, you know, pictures snipped out of magazines and newspapers, cars, clothes, devices, everything. Now you can punch up a picture of anything instantaneously, so there's no need for reference files anymore. But authenticity, in terms of having things look real, real cars, real settings, real clothes, that's very important, and, you know, that's indispensable. So study your anatomy, get used to drawing from reference, learn your perspective. That's three, you know, starters right there.
Now, for you personally, what do you like to draw more, dystopias or utopias?
That's a good question. One of the things that kind of made me approach the book this way is, I personally, you know, as I said, two of the biggest influences on me are Giger and Sid Mead. It's, you know, Giger, you know, it's pretty clear that if you're going to classify him one way or the other, you're going to call him dystopian. Sid Mead, it's a bit of an oversimplification, but he's generally leans towards, you know, the utopian side of things. I like, and because these two guys influence me both so strongly, I like to draw and envision and think about both utopias and dystopias. And I'm really fascinated by the fact that there's a lot of science fiction these days, a lot of science fiction movies, games, and historically, you know, things kind of, the needle goes back and forth, you know, depending on the mood and the temperament of the public and the kind of the, you know, zeitgeist out there, the future is presented in science fiction as either being really bad, you know, like in Soylent Green or The Road Warrior, or really good, like in Star Trek, for example. I'm fascinated by that, by the way our temperaments, you know, our attitudes influence the way we see the future. But in answer to your question, yeah, I really like presenting. I think that in you know it's kind of it's more fun probably to draw dystopian scenes, you know, because I don't know, it seems like there's an awful lot more material, really, you know, ugly, disfigured robots and people. I mean, there's just a lot there lending itself to the imagination. But I like both. But if I had to pick one or the other, I would probably skew towards dystopian visions.
I think it's because everybody's going, okay, the zombie apocalypse is going to start any day now. Can we just get it started and get it over with?
Yes. It's an awful, awful, awful lot of that. And I love it. I mean, The Walking Dead is pretty much the only thing I watch religiously on TV. and that's a reflection, you know, of there's something psychological going on, and that's a reflection of anxiety and fear, you know, in part at least, running through people at large. That whole preoccupation with this really hideous future, you know, which at the same time is kind of exciting. You know, you're watching The Walking Dead and it looks like, hey, it might be kind of fun to be in this tight-knit group fighting these creatures. It wouldn't really be, but it would smell abominable. They never mentioned that on the show.
That's true. I hadn't thought about the smell.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, the smell, and you know, another thing that's curious is all of those lurching zombies would be surrounded by clouds of flies and maggots. They never... If there was a bunch of zombies approaching, the first thing you would hear would be this low buzzing. No flies. Oh, well, there you go. Yeah.
I wonder what the fly budget would be. That would have to be digital, right?
Yeah, it seems like there would probably be some quick way of morphing in a cloud of flies, but I don't know.
Oh, my goodness. Well, the book is How to Draw Sci-Fi Utopias and Dystopias, featuring humans, aliens, robots, vehicles, cities of your dreams, and of your nightmares. I like that distinction. City of dreams, city of nightmares. It really is an intriguing read for anybody who has an interest in art. I mean, through the years, I've picked up the artwork books for favorite movies of mine, like The Matrix and Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
Especially Pacific Rim. Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's beautiful.
So we will have information here on the website for people to go check out their own copy. And thank you for your time today, Prentice.
Thank you so much, Summer. I've had a great time talking to you.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa, the first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award, with weekly stories from the world's best authors, Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more, with news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pole, Wolf, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
I'd like to thank Prentice for his time and his enthusiasm about discussing art and his desire to teach other people how to draw the various sci-fi visions they may have in their minds that they can't get out. It's a common problem. People have stories in their head and they're not quite sure how to get them out there. But we manage. We tell the stories when they're ready to be told, right? And as a bonus for our Slice of Sci-Fi listeners and fans, we're going to be giving away a couple of copies of the book, How to Draw Sci-Fi Utopias and Dystopias, signed by Prentice Rollins, along with two prints, also signed. So keep an eye on the website for that. The book will be available for everyone else to buy on September 27th. That's a couple weeks from now. The art in it is fascinating. It's compelling is the best word I can use for it. Both the dystopias and the utopias draw you in. There are sections where your eye is drawn to and you start looking at some of the detail, as detailed as it can be in the book. I mean, the book is gorgeous, and the art is printed on really heavy stock paper, but it's still a work of art. Your eye is drawn to certain sections, and then you start noticing little details that are in there, and I hope this book inspires a few more artists, because someday I'm going to need someone to draw the cover for my sci-fi novel. And, you know, if it's somebody I know, all the better, right? Yeah, I know. Now you're saying, well, wait a minute, Summer. Authors don't get to choose the cover artist for their books. They are if they're indie published. And I don't know what I'm going to do with that story yet. Mainly because the monster movie is taking up more of my time, and I'd really like to get that finished this century since I slacked. Hush, just hush. But, like I said, keep an eye out on the website for the contest information. Coming up during September, I hope we're going to have a chat. Myself, Noah, Darren, maybe a couple other folks, just talking about Marvel, the Marvel Universe on Netflix and on the big screen, because we've got Luke Cage coming up. We've seen the first teaser for Iron Fist. We've gotten more trailers for Doctor Strange, which looks awesome. I can't wait. Yes, I'm starting to soften on The Batch being Doctor Strange. We'll have to wait and see how the movie turns out, but so far I am enthusiastic and optimistic. Not even cautiously so. I am very enthusiastic, very optimistic. Doctor Strange was probably the very first Marvel character I became, I guess, really, really, really addicted to after Black Panther and the Avengers. And I actually stayed with Doc Strange and the X-Men after that before moving on to Daredevil and all sorts of other fun stuff with the Defenders. Reading the old Defenders series was very interesting. I remember that. So we'll have a Marvel Cinematic Universe chat, hopefully before Luke Cage drops. And if you enjoyed the interview with Aaron Wolf, the filmmaker of the indie horror monster movie Tar, stay tuned. We have a lot more indie filmmakers making monster movies, and I, for one, am kind of surprised and happy. I'm like, where are all these monster movies? Where have they been? Why are they just now coming to my attention? So we'll keep an eye out on those, and I'm looking forward to talking to these folks because monster movies are fun. That's what we should be having. Fun, right? the next week or two, the new fall series will be starting up. I can't wait for Lucifer. I hope they keep the tone of that balanced between the humor and the drama. I'm curious what the end game is going to be with Trisha Helfer as Lucifer's mom. And the one teaser I saw where it looks like Maze may be working against Lucifer. So is she following her own agenda? Is she following Mom's? I'm curious. And this curiosity is what will have me watching. looking forward to Van Helsing on Sci-Fi Channel, which starts next week, I believe. And what else is coming up immediately that I can think of? Drawing a blank, which means I need more caffeine. In any case, that will do it for this episode. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to call in. The number is 602-635-6976. Leave a voicemail message. We will play it. We'll listen to it. If you have a question and you don't want it played, let me know that too. If you have a longer comment to leave, go ahead and email that to me. summer@sliceofscifi.com. Record it yourself. Email me a link to it. And you know, you can always leave comments on the website, from the movie reviews to TV reviews and interviews like this one. If you have a question, that's the best way to get your question to some of the guests I have on here. Leave a comment on the website because they're checking them out too, you know. If you listen to the show through Stitchers or iTunes, leave us a review there. You can check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and on Krypton Radio, one of the premier internet radio stations available, and the only 100% 24/7 sci-fi themed internet station out there. Check it out. You will enjoy it, I'm sure. Check us out on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi. Check us out on Google Plus and YouTube, Slice of Sci-Fi in both places. And of course, there's the website, sliceofscifi.com. We also have writersafterdark.com, popculturegeeks.com, and kickassmysticninjas.com. Keep your eye out for those ninjas. They sneak up on you in the most unexpected ways and methods. Ha ha. Yes, I'm teasing, but it's for a good cause, trust me. I'd like to thank everyone for your donations and your pledges. If you want to help support the show, you can go over to patreon.com/sliceofscifi. All of your donations and pledges do help keep the show running. It helps with the costs for hosting the websites, for hosting the media, and that helps me out keeping the show going. It really does. I can't express fully my appreciation for your continued support and belief in what I'm doing here, what I'm trying to do here. So thank you very much, everyone. Also, my great thanks to the geek rock band Psy Fried for their music here. The incredible work they put into the theme music and interstitial music that we use on the show here. Their creation. Their excellent work. And, oh, by the way, in honor of Star Trek anniversary this month, you need to go check out their video, A Tall Ship. It is truly a thing of beauty, a wonder to behold. It shows the level of geekiness of Star Trek fandom that these guys are in. And that Star Trek fandom helped them create a family, a band that produces awesome music. So to all the guys at Sci-Fried, my great thanks, and keep on trekking. Yeah, I'm just showing my geek card fail there. But if you want to check out more music from the guys, go over to sci-fried.com. And that'll do it for us. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.